So we're going to move from Africa to Latin America. As she said, I'm Alice Douglas, and I work for Ciccatelli Associates, CAI, as we are now called, in Manhattan. And I'm going to discuss implementing biobehavioral surveillance HIV studies among uniform services in Latin America and the lessons we learned from this implementation. And so the learning objectives are to identify barriers and facilitators to implement a biobehavioral surveillance study, also known as a BBSS, in multiple Latin American countries. So again, this was not an effort by myself or CAI alone, but a collaboration with multiple partners. We partnered with DHAP, which is the Department of Defense HIV and AIDS Prevention Program, National Ministries of Health, Security and Defense, universities throughout Latin America, COPRECOS, which stands for the Committee on the Prevention and Control of HIV and AIDS in the Uniformed Services and Police in Latin America and Caribbean, and CAI staff both in New York and throughout the region, together to form the Avanzada COPRECOS LAC project. This is a project to increase HIV as evidence-based prevention strategies, including the reduction of stigma, discrimination, and gender inequity in the uniformed services, which includes the police forces as well as the Army, Navy, and Marines within the uniformed services. It was in 15 countries in Latin America. We received funding from the Global Fund, Round 9 funding, for a 5-year project, which was implemented in 2 phases with a staggered rollout of countries within phase 1. And it involved condom distribution, voluntary counseling and testing, and uniformed peer educators with a robust monitoring and evaluation system. So to provide a little background on this project and also why we did a baseline, members of the uniformed service are hypothesized to be at a greater risk for HIV and STI than the general population. Several studies in Africa amongst uniformed personnel found that there are elevated risks for multiple reasons, including being away from home, engaging in transactional sex and other risky behavior, including alcohol and drug use, being deployed to regions with higher HIV prevalence, inconsistently using and having access to condoms, being subject to a work ethos that encourages and or excuses risk-taking, and also having more power and influence than the local population. And so while it's projected that there was a high prevalence in Latin America, no baseline statistics existed. So we needed to do a baseline study to inform programmatic and policy planning and to assess our effectiveness, and also to provide the countries with nationally relevant data that they could use for future projects and initiatives. So in conducting the baseline studies, we did the BBSS, which has a behavioral and a biological component. We used evidence-informed behavioral surveys administered using a CASI, which is audio computer assisted self-interview. So the participants used a netbook computer. They could hear the questions and use a stylus pen to answer the questions. The questions were on knowledge of HIV transmission and prevention, sexual risk behavior, and also their attitudes towards people living with HIV in vulnerable populations. There were also components on PTSD, sexual coercion, and alcohol abuse that countries could opt to include as well. We used rapid HIV tests for the serological data, and some countries also decided to include STI testing, depending on collaborations with their Ministry of Health and external collaborations with the Department of Defense. IRB approval was obtained in each country from a local IRB for the questionnaire protocol and informed consent, and this was created by a local PI in collaboration with the PI at the headquarters in New York. We had daily logs to observe and document observations throughout the study, and sampling was intended to be randomized, but due to several issues I will discuss, it was convenient in most countries. So here's a brief summary of the results. We did the BBS in 10 countries. I have the list here. Paraguay, Colombia, Panama, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Dominican Republic, Peru, Uruguay, Argentina, and Brazil. With over 9,000 participants from over 100 bases, the average age was 26, the vast majority were male, and less than a quarter had more than a high school education. This breaks down the sampling. We used a UNAIDS estimate of national adult prevalence for HIV to determine the sample size. And within that, we used a regional targeted population identification strategy to identify areas within the country with high levels of risk for HIV and STIs. So for example, in Peru, there were 25,000 active police and military personnel, and we determined the sample over 1,100 would be statistically powerful. where there were 6 key indicators that we used to track outcomes, 1 for the prevalence of HIV and 5 on knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors about HIV and STI risk. These are the general aggregate results for all 10 countries that we've implemented in so far. And I'd like to point out that overall we've only found a prevalence of 0.09% in these countries, which compared to the general population of approximately 1% is actually lower than what we thought would be. And also I'd like to point out number 5, which is the ability to correctly identify ways of preventing transmission and rejecting major misconceptions. 30% or approximately were able to answer only 75% of these questions correctly. Less than 1% could answer all questions correctly. So there's a very low level of knowledge and awareness about HIV in these communities. So during implementation, there were many facilitators that assisted us both prior to implementation, during, and post. Primary and first and foremost was engagement of local country teams. This proved to be very effective. We had a baseline planning meeting in Panama prior to implementation of all countries in which PIs from each country came. This way they were all on the same page when it came to study protocol, how to implement, going through the IRB process, the staffing components that were requisite for each study team. We pilot tested the questionnaires in each country to make sure they were culturally relevant and that they included wording that was appropriate in that country, and we collaborated in the selection of study sites within those areas of high risk. We chose to do local IRB approval for each country instead of doing a U.S. institutional review board. This was for ease on our part, but also put the onus on the local PI to do the approval process and allowed us to do tweaks and tailor each questionnaire and protocol for the country and what they were looking for as well as what we wanted. We did voice recordings for the Akazi by native speakers, and we had preliminary meetings prior to study implementation to talk about the protocol, develop a sampling pattern, also talk about roles and responsibilities. This proved very important given the hierarchical nature of the military. When in Uruguay, there were 2 colonels on my team, and had we not discussed the roles and responsibilities prior to implementation, we might have had a bit of a power struggle. We also engaged high-ranking retired military officials on each study team. These men and women facilitated a study implementation and helped us address potential political challenges. They also provided a sense of legitimacy to the study team. Instead of just a young gringa coming in, there was a man who or a woman who knew how things worked in this military and can talk to the colonels and the commanding officers. We also relied on country-specific experts to navigate local policies. We shipped our netbooks computers to these countries, and I don't know if any of you have dealt with customs in some countries in Latin America, but it can be a nightmare. So having a local on the ground to help us get the computers out in time for study implementation was critical. And afterwards, we reviewed the daily log to understand facilitators and barriers so we could improve the study process in subsequent countries. We had a closeout meeting for PIs in which they could discuss their lessons learned, in which they kind of create a sense of community amongst them. And we collaborated with local project staff to disseminate the results both to the Global Fund and also to create country-specific reports to disseminate within internal stakeholders. All is not smooth sailing, however. There were many barriers we came across throughout the implementation process. There was a tight grant stipulated timeline for study implementation, which was often complicated by these local IRB review processes. In addition, there are many national holidays in Latin America that aren't observed in the United States, and during which many government employees don't work. So the months of December and January, for example, no one works for the Christmas. There's Carnival and Semana Santa. There were budget restrictions on top of that that I had to deal with. It was sometimes difficult to find staff with the requisite experience, both in language and technical experience. And again, the shipment of computers. Despite having a local expert on the ground, we weren't always able to get the computers out of customs in time, so we had to find a plan B, which in this case was renting 50 laptops in Peru to use in the study implementation. And it also made we had to include a component of teaching participants how to use a laptop, which brought up issues of computer literacy. As I said, it was difficult to manage the dynamics of a complex team given the hierarchical nature of some of the study members. There were varying levels of PI experience and understanding of the role of the PI. In some countries, they had scientific background, and in those countries, we were able to do randomized sampling, and they really adhered to the protocol. In other countries, they thought it was more of an honorific role. For example, in Guatemala, the PI was a high-level general who had never had done a study and didn't even know how to turn on a computer. So that was complicated matters for our team as well as the study team. In addition, motivating voluntary troop participation was difficult at times given the low awareness of HIV in these countries. They didn't have the impetus as much to volunteer to get a test done or to fill out the survey. Also, we weren't always sure that they were volunteers, given that this is in the military. If a commanding officer tells his troops to participate, it's rare that they're going to say no. There were always safety considerations for international and local staff and unforeseen political roadblocks that we had to deal with. In dissemination, it was difficult to debrief and share results among the different countries as militaries were reluctant to share this information on prevalence of HIV within their troops as they saw it as a threat to their national security. And broader dissemination of the results, even in the aggregate form, they were hesitant to do. And if we were to do it, it involved us collaborating with 11 PIs in 11 different countries. And again, balancing the funding requirements and their desire to have us publicize these results with the local stakeholder wishes to keep this private were difficult things to balance. So in conclusion, key to implementation of projects in multiple countries is to involve local stakeholders, local members from the target population who can help in the study design and implementation, assisting to solve any unforeseen roadblocks and really ease the transition. It's also important to collaborate with the local PI and IRB for in-country buy-in, support, and also sustainability for future projects. Engaging local experts to understand local attitudes and the socio-political construct is important. As was mentioned from the African studies, there's a high level of stigma and taboo associated with HIV. And so acknowledging this prior to implementation and talking about it is really helpful to get buy-in from the locals. And understanding the historical context, the U.S. does not have the best reputation for research in Latin America. So being cognizant of this fact and presenting it in a way that understands that and takes that into context helps deal with the skepticism and reluctance by some country leaders. And in conclusion, many barriers can be eliminated with extensive planning and collaboration with local stakeholders, and one must be flexible and creative always when faced with unforeseen challenges. Thank you.
All right, so Dr. Benacourt is going to take questions first because she has to leave a little early. So if anybody has particular questions for her, I don't know if you guys want to sit up here. I put chairs up, so maybe that would be easiest. Yeah, thank you. Anybody for Dr. Benacourt at all? No? I have a question. Dang. Okay, it's a pretty easy question. For the treatment, or for the trauma psychoeducation, because I'm a licensed clinical social worker, so I was wondering what specific kind of trauma, other than psychoeducation, was there any therapy done or intervention in regard to that for their mental health to try to reduce intrusive thoughts or flashbacks and things like of that nature?
So in the four components of the intervention, you saw the fourth one was navigating formal and informal supports and services. So rather than trying to treat a caregiver who may have a serious mental health problem in a family-based preventative intervention with lay facilitators, what we would do is help them link up to the existing mental health services at Partners in Health, and they do have a mental health program. Sometimes that took a lot of work. We had a mom with untreated psychosis that we had to do a lot of work with her that was more along the lines of, you know, helping with case management to get her evaluated at the Central Psychiatric Hospital, and then she got on a treatment program with medication, came back and was in a much better place. And we've had many parents referred for depression treatment and PTSD-related services. So the level of care in Rwanda is still limited. Like, we don't have great substance abuse treatment, and that's a huge problem in a lot of these families, especially families where a father may be living with HIV, or, you know, there's a long history of risky behaviors, perhaps. So that's one area where we feel most frustrated, is getting substance abuse treatment that's evidence-based. But for things like depression and trauma-related consequences, there's decent care in Rwanda, so we'd help them access it. Okay, great. I have to go get my kids now.
I'm studying Latin America. sure from, maybe I just didn't hear. Was the testing voluntary? You applied the informed consent.
Yes.
So there was voluntary exclusion as well? Or was it mandatory if they were asked to go through this? They had to in order to?
No.
Was it anonymous?
So it wasn't anonymous, but there was informed consent. And you can opt to do both the behavioral and the biological component, or one or the other. What I was referring to is that they were allowed to sign their informed consent, but sometimes with a commanding officer standing there, we weren't sure how comfortable some participants felt declining to participate.
So could they decline?
They could. They could absolutely decline.
But under the...
Right. So this is not ever, like, something that was talked about.
Under the view of their officer.
Right.
So there really wasn't much opportunity to...
There were participants who did. There were multiple times that people said, I don't want to participate. No questions were asked, and they left.
And no consequences?
That I know of.
Okay. And you considered validating your prevalence, your prevalence with anonymous, unlinked testing to the blood bank sources.
Within the military population?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be a thing to do.
That would be the thing.
But they're not very willing to share that information with outside sources, I will say.
Right, but at least you would have, if the blood banks, the military sources, they have blood banks and large samples, and you could do unlinked, anonymous testing to get a seroprevalence in that exact population that would be unbiased by disclosure and stigma.
Yeah.
Then you'd have a real problem. Just a suggestion.
I have a question, kind of building on terms of the prevalence rate. I mean, they're obviously very low, so it seems like there's probably something going on there, but was there any discussion? Did it seem like everybody was sort of in agreement that these were low because of participation in the testing, or was there any thought that maybe these rates were low because we just misinformed about what HIV rates were in this population?
Or self-selected to be the negative self-out test.
Right. Well, I think it's a combination of the two, that the prevalence wasn't as high as we anticipated, but also there was a selection bias. People who had high-risk behaviors were more likely not to participate, we guess. Also, they do testing in the military, so if you already know your status, you're not going to show up for testing. So there was a self-selection, and as I noted, they're pretty young. People who showed up, and there's a healthy bias effect here going on. So the more years you're in the military, the more chances you have to get infected. So there was also that to contend with.
And the ones who knew they were positive weren't showing up.
Right.
And the general is not going to bring up all the positive rowdy guys who knew they were rabble rousers in the whorehouses all the time. They're not going to cart those guys up front and skew their statistics.
Right. It makes their company look bad.
Right.
Anybody else have a question?
Okay. So of course everybody's below population prevalence.
Anybody else? If not, that's totally fine. I know it's like later, you know, tired. But so I just want to thank the presenters, awesome work, and Dr. Benacourt as well. Thanks for coming, and if you have any questions, I'm sure you'll stay here until any questions personally, you can bring them up to the person, and that will be great. Awesome. Thank you.